This is Bloomberg Intelligence.
Uber wants to be the Amazon of retail, of e-commerce.
The Disney Plus service might actually end up benefiting Netflix.
In-depth research and data on 2,000 companies and 130 industries.
Capital return is the key story for the U.S. banks.
The telcos naturally are moving into content distribution. I think it's a good move.
Bloomberg Intelligence with Alex Steele and Paul Sweeney on Bloomberg Radio.
Over the next hour, we're going to dig inside the big business stories impacting Wall Street and the global markets.
Each and every week, we provide in-depth research and data on some of the 2,000 companies and 130 industries our analysts cover worldwide.
Today, we're going to take a look at life insurance and why normalization to pre-pandemic rates is providing some relief.
Plus, why REIT winners may boost edge versus weaker peers as bond yields rise.
So let's begin with the financials, because they're navigating higher rates. They're also awaiting help on the short end. Well, joining us to walk us through this is Bloomberg Intelligence senior industry analyst Herman Achan. So, Herman, as we see a relatively steeper yield curve and yields move higher across the board, well, how does that impact financial? Who wins?
Sure. So the steeper yield curve really helps all the financials, given that bigger picture, the steeper yield curve portends higher interest rates down the road, which is helpful for financials. It also portends better economic activity, as you've seen with the stimulus that has been helpful for financials and banks in particular to really keep a lid tightly on loan losses and improve credit quality. So, and you've seen that financial stocks and bank stocks in particular, the yield curve has portended to really lift valuations for the financial sector and bank stocks. So all in all, really, really helpful for the banks. Less so for net interest margins. You really need to see the short end move higher, but it's definitely helpful to help as banks reprice their fixed rate loans. Those will reprice a bit better given the steeper curve.
All right, so Herman, if I'm looking at the bank sector, looking at a rising rate environment, do I have a preference for some of the big money center banks that may have some investment banking exposure, or do I want to stick to maybe some of the more regional banks, which are tied to maybe more loan origination, net interest margin improvement?
That's right. So the regionals have more exposure to net interest income versus fee income. We'd say that's more of a 60-70% of the revenue base for regionals is tied to interest rates, whereas for the investment banks, it's more about 50-50. So if we're banking on a steeper curve, if we're banking on potential short end rising, that will help regional banks more, but it'll lift all banks in general.
What part of it is also demand driven? And where is the strength there, I guess?
Yeah, so demand has been tough. It's been a challenge for banks in general to grow their loan book. And that's really due to a few factors. You have all the stimulus money coming in, so you're not seeing credit card borrowers really carry balances that much anymore because they can pay off their debt. You're seeing business customers be really cautious in terms of borrowing from their lines of credit from banks. And you've seen the larger corporates really access the bond market instead of their borrowing from banks because of really low interest rates for the most part in 2020. So you saw a lot of bond issuance to pay off bank lending. So all in all, it's been quite a challenge for the banks to grow their loan portfolio. Deposits, on the other hand, have been really strong given that all the stimulus money and all the QE quantitative easing by the Fed has really created a lot of deposits that sit on the bank balance sheets, but there's not a lot of opportunities to lend at this point.
Is that hopeful
for a second half rebound in lending, but still it's a wait and see type approach.
Yeah, that's kind of where I want to go, Herman. I mean, it seems like, there is this big reopening trade out there affecting a lot of sectors. Investors, kind of maybe going to rotate out of some of the pandemic sectors and try to take advantage of that. Is there a call there for the banks? Is there history to suggest that, boy, they're going to start writing a lot of loans as people look to start businesses on the back end of this?
Yeah, definitely. I would say that banks go as GDP type goes, right? So if you see expectations for a strong rebound in GDP, that helps banks of all stripes. Banks are hopeful for, as I mentioned before, banks are hopeful for a second half rebound just because they could see potential normalization in these drawdowns of their business credit lines in a recovery type scenario. And that'll be helpful. And as we just move further towards the recovery period and back to a period of normalization, you could potentially see a rebound in loan growth, which would be helpful for the top line for banks.
Something that's really helped, if you just focus on, say, the big banks, has been killer trading revenue. So I'm interested as to how you see that part of the business that has been so helpful as the curve hasn't really gone anywhere and demand, as you said, has been kind of squishy.
So my colleague Allison Williams covers the largest banks and the investment banks, and she probably could be a better assistance with that. But for the most part, we think banks will have pretty strong trading results, but the comps are tough from a year over year standpoint. So that's something to watch out for.
No, fair enough. Absolutely. All right. Herman Chan, thank you very much. Really appreciate it at Bloomberg Intelligence.
Coming up on the program, how Fed moves may spur life insurance deals.
You're listening to Bloomberg Intelligence on Bloomberg Radio, providing in-depth research and data on 2,000 companies and 130 industries. You can access Bloomberg Intelligence through BI Go on the terminal. I'm Alex Steele.
And I'm Paul Sweeney. It's 13 minutes past the hour, and this is Bloomberg.
This is Bloomberg Intelligence with Alex Steele and Paul Sweeney on Bloomberg Radio.
Well, our next guest writes that the recent rise in 10-year Treasury yields has eased the drag on life insurers' portfolio returns. To help us understand, we welcome Bloomberg Intelligence industry analyst Jeff Flynn. All right, Jeff, you've been looking at these life insurance companies for a long time. We're entering into a period that appears to be pretty significant rate increases after a period of just incredibly low rates. How do you play it in the insurance space?
Well, no, it's it's definitely a big relief. I mean, it's very positive for the group. I mean, in terms of portfolio yield, it's a definite positive. I mean, with over the last couple of years, the portfolio new money yields have been so far below the roll-off that I think there was about a mid-single-digit kind of drag on earnings, and that should come down to sort of a low single-digit drag, in my opinion. I also note that there's some life insurers that have a little bit more spread-based business that's kind of driven more by interest rates than by premiums and underwriting, some shorter duration businesses there. Those businesses could see a little bit earlier boost more quickly. I'd also note that on variable annuity business, the reserving dynamic relative to long-term guarantees is much more positive over the long term in terms of distributable earnings from those businesses. So those are some areas that should see some of the positive benefits.
So not to like dumb this down too much for me, but I think it might be worth going over like what types of insurers are kind of out there. And as you were mentioning, like how they wind up really making their money to understand like who is levered and what's the beta to interest rates.
One of the things I would note that it's just a little tricky right now because all in my opinion, just because they have interest rates have come up a lot, but they're still quite low on an absolute level. So over the next year or so, I certainly see returns on equity getting quite a bit better, but I think that'll be mostly from kind of COVID claims dissipating over the next few quarters, and then share buybacks should kind of return to their more normal level. In terms of the impact from interest rates, there's some companies that have a little bit more exposure, I would say. A company like MetLife has a little bit more in their retirement business that has more shorter duration businesses. Prudential is a little bit more exposed. But I think that the point is that the earnings impact will play out from higher rates will play out over a number of years and somewhat slowly. So although as opposed to the stocks, which have obviously moved much more quickly, kind of in anticipation of even higher rates.
All right. So, Jeff, just give us a sense. You know, I love getting an understanding of how various industries have been impacted by the pandemic and the economic disruption. Give us the view from the life insurance business. How has it been impacted?
Well, I think there's just been, certainly, earnings were under a pretty significant amount of pressure from the claims from COVID, but that should kind of dissipate. I think there was just really an acceleration in terms of, it was already happening, but just in terms of their focus on building out their technology capabilities and really giving their agents or their distribution partners the capabilities to kind of go in that direction. I would just note a couple companies like Primerica is a good example of a retail company. It sells retail term insurance, but they've just become much more effective in terms of having their agents kind of work over Zoom, you know, or work digitally in terms of just sort of going kind of more in person. I think it's just made them more efficient. That's one of the impacts. I think the other major impact that we've seen is just in terms of there's definitely some just in terms of transaction activity, it's been pretty active in the space, and I think that will continue. And that's kind of sort of just was reflecting the pressure on a lot of these businesses from the lower interest rates the past year, and in the preceding years. That sort of has encouraged a trend for companies to focus on their core businesses and exit some businesses that are that have higher capital requirements or really weren't being valued very well at all in the public markets. We just, for example, Equitable recently exited a portion of a variable annuity business that have been real valuation drags. So it's been very active in terms of transaction activity, and you can kind of see that reflected in AIG thinking about or planning to separate their life business, and there's a number of other items like in that area.
What's the most profitable and the best business model that's kind of emerged in the insurance land?
Yeah, I mean, the thing with life insurers, or at least the group that's kind of called life insurers, they operate in quite a few businesses. They operate in traditional life insurance. They operate in group insurance. They operate in annuities. And then there's sort of 401k businesses. So it's really, they're in quite a few different things. But I think that the model that's really sort of emerging is, and it's sort of being demanded by the market. They want much less less long duration, complex liabilities, less kind of variable annuity risk, where it's very hard to know what the liability is going to be, and much more kind of shorter duration business that's valued with a much higher price to book. Like things like the group insurance, where MetLife is very large, which is insurance that's sold at the work site. That's been expanding. People seem to like to buy insurance from their employer, so that's been growing. Becoming bigger in the businesses that you're in, sort of there's been a good amount of consolidation in 401k, and we think that will continue. So it's really sort of shifting into businesses where companies are already strong, and definitely away from businesses where the long tail kind of liability is very unpredictable. Something like long-term care, a lot of the companies have exited that, and they're looking to exit those off of their books.
Hey, Jeff, I'm looking at some of the year-to-date stock price performance for some of these life insurers. Pretty darn good, 15, 20, 25% for the likes of Prudential and Equitable. Talk to me about valuation. Where are we here in terms of valuation for this group? Is there more room to grow as, again, presumably the yields continue to rise a little bit?
Yeah, no, I think that there is still a little bit of room. You know, I think that I would note that they've kind of gotten back to sort of, you know, they were obviously in October and November they were at record lows, something like 0.6 or 0.7 times the book value. Now they've come back to sort of the middle of their range, somewhere around 1.1 times book value.
Interesting. All right, Jeff. Hey, thanks so much for bringing us up to date on all things in the insurance industry in an environment where we're seeing rates rise. Jeff Flynn, Bloomberg Intelligence, Senior Industry Analyst.
Coming up on the program, the impacts of rising government bond yields on REIT pricing.
You're listening to Bloomberg Intelligence on Bloomberg Radio, providing in-depth research and data on 2,000 companies and 130 industries. You can access Bloomberg Intelligence via BI Go on the terminal. I'm Paul Sweeney.
And I'm Alex Steele. It's 25 minutes past the hour, and this is Bloomberg.
This is Bloomberg Intelligence with Alex Steele and Paul Sweeney on Bloomberg Radio.
Well, we'll be here each and every week at this time, tapping into our Bloomberg Intelligence analysts covering some 2,000 companies and 130 industries worldwide.
So let's continue the conversation of what happens to certain sectors on these higher bond yields. Next up, we're going to take a look at REITs, helping us to break it all down. Bloomberg Intelligence senior industry analyst Sue Munden. Sue, first off, as we see higher bond yields pretty much globally, what is the impact on REITs and sort of how are they diverging and how are they similar?
Yes, the pricing of REITs has diverged because of the underlying fundamentals of the different sectors. So as we've gone through COVID, you'll have noticed that we've done a lot more online shopping. And so what's happened is that the retail sector has really suffered, whereas the logistics and warehouse property owners have really benefited. So at the moment, we see a really big divide in the valuations of the listed European REITs, with REITs that are invested in retail often as much as 50% discounted versus their net asset value, whereas a REIT like SEGRO, which is invested in logistics, is about 10% above its net asset value, and offices are somewhere in the middle.
All right, so Sue, is there an expectation? Let's just start with the retail rates, REITs, because that really fascinates me as I think about how we're all going to behave on the other side of this pandemic. Will we go back to stores? Will we fill the shopping malls? What's the expectation from a REIT owner perspective?
Well, the REIT owners have been worried, obviously. They're concerned in the short term about vacancy, especially in countries like the UK, where the tenants have been protected. They haven't had to pay their rent. And so there's been a sort of debate with the tenants and the landlords to try and make sure that they can all pay their rent, that they're helping them as much as possible, so that when we can open up, they will be able to open and they won't fail. But nevertheless, we've got that crunch coming. I think that the landlords that have done the best they can to help their tenants, at least they're in the best position. But nevertheless, there is going to be more vacancy this year. We've already seen vacancy rates rise over the last 6 months.
Are you noticing a distinction between Europe and the UK, as Europe just cannot get its vaccination act together and the UK is like surging ahead in that?
Yeah, I think that sort of tipping point where we actually see what's going to happen to the retailers when they're sort of weaned off government support and when the shops properly open is probably going to come sooner in the UK, because our inoculation program in the UK is a little bit more advanced than it is in Europe. That said, in the UK, we also have much higher online penetration. So that what's happened over the last year is that online penetration has grown about 15 percentage points, which is more than 10 years of normal movement, you know, all in 1 year. And can that reverse, or will we continue to do it? And, you know, as you asked earlier, Paul, you know, what is the situation there? How are we going to behave? And I think that people will go to the best shopping malls. I think they'll go out and they'll enjoy it. You know, we want a day out. But how much of that shopping is done online, the actual sales, and how much is done in the shops, you know, the jury's out on that. And so can there be a way of sort of measuring the ability of having a shop there of actually driving sales online? So yeah. There's lots of different things going on in the retailer market at the moment. I think a lot of the rents are now being set so that there's some kind of turnover or even footfall component to how it's arranged. And, you know, there's probably still a bit more pain to come.
Yeah, it's interesting. I think on the retail side, that's a big unknown. And I think another big unknown post-pandemic and how people are going to interact is how we're going to work. Are we going to go back to the office? How much are we going to go back to the office? Where are those offices going to be? So, Susan, from a REIT perspective, how are those office REITs performing? And what's the expectation over the next 1 to 3 to 5 years as to, you know, vacancies and all that type of thing?
And a good one. And I think the market's probably also not really sure what the answer is. So in the office REITs across Europe, we've got a span of about 15% discount to net asset value through to 35. And there are the moving parts in that. Some of it is to do with what's the immediate growth in the next 2 years. So if there's rental rental growth because they've developed some properties and they're coming online and they've got tenants for them so that they're going to have a jump up in rental income and they can pay more dividends, and that's a good thing. And then conversely, a company like Jacena that's got quite a lot in its pipeline at the moment that's delivering in the next 18 months that hasn't yet been let, and will they be able to let it out? And therefore, their income might not grow so fast and the dividend's flat. You know, all of these things go into the pot. Now, the hybrid working model, I think everybody feels that there is going to be some of that. I think it will depend by sector. I think it will depend by types of client.
Sue, really good to get the perspective. Thank you very much. Sue Munden, Bloomberg Intelligence, a senior industry analyst.
Coming up on the program, the impact of reopenings on internet valuations. Yes, there is a link.
You are listening to Bloomberg Intelligence on Bloomberg Radio, providing in-depth research and data on 2,000 companies and 130 industries. You can access Bloomberg Intelligence through BitGo on the terminal. I'm Alex Steele.
And I'm Paul Sweeney. It's 39 minutes past the hour, and this is Bloomberg.
This is Bloomberg Intelligence with Alex Steele and Paul Sweeney on Bloomberg Radio.
Well, the world is slowly reopening, so let's take a look at the impact that has on ad budgets and then internet valuations. Here to walk us through it, Bloomberg Intelligence senior industry analyst Mandeep Singh. I'm guessing the link here is more advertisers going to Google and then Google making more money off of advertisers. Is this a gist?
Well, not just Google. I think there are more vendors that can benefit, notably the smaller ad companies, you know, like Snap, like Pinterest, like Twitter. So our view is, look, some of the changes that have transpired with COVID, you know, including the shift to e-commerce, it's going to drive a lot of ad budgets towards digital channels as opposed to traditional TV and, you know, brand advertising that we saw over the years. And that will actually benefit a lot of these smaller players who have their own niches, you know. So net-net, I think this is a longer-term trend that's not going to reverse. Obviously, with reopenings, you know, some of the e-commerce players have very tough comps to be measured against. And, you know, the valuations are stretched and those may come down, but the longer term trends will be intact around advertising, around e-commerce, and those will be there at least for the next 4 or 5 years.
Yeah, I think, Mandeep, you know, from the perspective of Madison Avenue, the trends have been and continue to be quite clear in terms of ad dollars on the margin going towards digital. The concern on Madison Avenue was, boy, it's kind of a duopoly, maybe if you want to include Amazon, a triopoly, and that's not good for my customers who I'm trying to negotiate rates for. Is that still the case, that it's just a two or three really big companies, Facebook, Amazon, and Google, just soaking up all the dollars?
Yeah, so that has traditionally been the case when it comes to digital ads, and it's not going to change, even with, you know, the ad shift that you're talking about for the next few years. It's going to take a while for a Snap or a Twitter to really, you know, stack up against the likes of Facebook, which really, if you break down Facebook's ad revenue, it is driven to an extent by Instagram. So Instagram, yep, is about $30 billion in annual sales now, growing at a 40% clip. And the core Facebook is growing, you know, high teens. And that just goes to show the power of Facebook comes from all the platforms that it owns. And in case of Google, it's really the search dominance. So I think you're going to see a trend towards more social advertising. And the fact that Snap has a niche with, you know, the younger demographic, Twitter has a niche with the professional workers who really consume all the news on Twitter. Over time, you're going to, like, I think Snap and Twitter will double their revenue in the next 2 to 3 years. So that just goes to show that the momentum is quite strong when it comes to top-line growth for some of these smaller players.
Well, what about for the travel sites? How does the reopening, aside from, like, they get more business, how are they helped?
Yeah, so the comps are super easy for, you know, travels. And going back to Paul's
up 900% year on year.
So, you know, it's also a triopoly. You know, you've got Booking, Expedia, and now Airbnb. And really, nothing has changed in terms of the travel dynamics. The demand is going to come back. There is huge pent-up demand over there. And it's just a matter of execution. Yes, Expedia has more exposure to corporate travel, so they will be the slowest to come back in terms of top line. Mm. But other than that, Airbnb has this a huge niche that they have created around alternative accommodations and vacation rentals, and they're just running away with the market. And that will actually show up in EBITDA growth. So a lot of these unicorns were not profitable. Guess what? That will change with Airbnb. We are actually modeling for 25 to 30% EBITDA margins for Airbnb once you see a full top-line recovery.
All right, Mandy. Well, while we have you, I have to ask about the whole Uber Lyft situation. Tell us, what are the current trends for those companies in terms of ridership? You know, kind of where are we relative to pre-pandemic levels? What's the outlook for maybe getting back there?
Yeah, so ride sharing, again, is about 50% of pre-COVID levels, and that will be slow to come back. But we know for sure that ride sharing is a better gross margin business than food delivery. So what will happen is a lot of the drivers who were actually, you know, driving for food delivery vendors are going to come back to ride sharing once the demand comes back, because it's better for the driver. And it's just, you know, like I said, a higher gross margin business for the companies that are in this business. So I do think Lyft, the fact that it's at the same valuation as Uber, is somewhat, you know, kind of at a lower or a discounted multiple simply because of the profitability potential that they have once they're, a full top-line recovery. And that's where I do think, you are going to see a shift towards ride-sharing, especially when it comes to investors and how they value these companies. Food delivery demand is going to be with us, but first, they have much tougher comps this mm-hmm. year. And the fact that they will have a tough time retaining those drivers and couriers will lead to, you know, more driver subsidies that they will have to roll out to, you know, maintain their business.
Well, that's actually where I was going to pick up, because, you know, we saw Deliveroo come under a lot of heat for supposedly the way that they treat their delivery guys. Obviously, Uber had a loss in London, and then over in California, they have to classify some drivers differently. Do we have a real idea yet of the social impact from the pandemic that they're going to see and the hit that they might take to their bottom line?
Yeah, so again, with food delivery, we think there will be a handful of vendors that will be profitable in the near to medium term. DoorDash has shown us that they can carve out a subscription model. Obviously, even they have a tough time retaining their couriers and drivers. But at the end of the day, the companies that will be successful in food and grocery delivery will have to come up with a recurring subscription model. That is what will allow them to treat their drivers and couriers well and really have a sustainable business model.
Subscription business model. I'm not even sure if any of your companies have a net profit, Mandeep.
Well, I just mentioned about Airbnb. I mean,
there's the one. I mean, come on. There's the one guy.
and Pinterest. Actually, a lot of people are surprised how Pinterest is EBITDA profitable, even at such a low revenue base. And that just goes to show, you know, if you execute well and you have, you know, all your costs kind of mm-hmm. contained, you can be profitable.
I finally understood Pinterest while I was moving and having to decorate a new apartment. So I'm only like a million years too late. Mandeep, thanks a lot. We love talking to you. Mandeep Singh, a Bloomberg Intelligence Senior Industry Analyst.
All right, switching our focus to European banks and their non-interest income outlook. Joining us with this is Bloomberg Intelligence industry analyst Georgi Gunchev. Georgi, thanks so much for joining us here. We've been spending a lot of time, and I'm sure you have too, with clients talking about steepening yield curve and what that means for net interest income for these banks. But let's talk about the fee income. What has the fee income scenario been during the pandemic? And more importantly, what's the outlook on the other side of this?
Yeah, sure. So fees, like net interest income, they took a hit during the pandemic. declining by about 3% on average for the European banks. And this was driven by the lockdown. So it was more of a H1 2020 effect. However, the situation improved in the second half of the year, and banks over-delivered on their 4Q consensus. So the fee outlook is a bright spot for European bank revenues, and we believe it can outpace the growth of net interest income.
But long-term rates are rising, whether you like it or not, over in Europe and here in the U.S. So how does that affect net interest income, and shouldn't that sort of push that even higher?
Yeah, sure. I mean, certainly long-term interest rates are rising. In Europe, they haven't risen as much as in the U.S. And also, in Europe, short-term rates are at all-time lows. And ultimately, short-term rates, determine the pricing of a large proportion of bank loans. Furthermore, the long growth outlook in Europe remains quite lackluster. So yes, we believe net interest income for the banks could stabilize in 2021 and potentially grow in 2022, 2023, but we don't, that growth is still going to be quite low, because even though, as I said, longer term rates are rising, there are other issues. There's excess liquidity, there is the weak long growth outlook, and ultimately net interest income, we don't really expect any material move in consensus yet. But with that being said, we still think there are a number of, positive potential catalysts for European banks' revenue upgrades.
Georgi, thanks a lot. We truly appreciate Georgi Gunchev, a Bloomberg Intelligence industry analyst.
That's this week's edition of Bloomberg Intelligence on Bloomberg Radio, providing in-depth research and data on 2,000 companies and 130 industries.
And remember, you can access Bloomberg Intelligence through BIGO on the terminal. I'm Alex Steele.
And I'm Paul Sweeney. It's 57 minutes past the hour, and this is Bloomberg.